Good morning, friends. Normally, we sit towards the back, so I get to watch all of you, you know, dancing and comment on you when I get up for my sermon about your dance moves and all that. I have to say, however, sitting up front is better. Hearing you sing has been fantastic this morning. There's 1,000 things we could be doing today, 1,000 ways we could be spending our time. And in fact, many people have said, you know, gathering in an assembly like this, it's a waste of time. And I love what Marva Dawn said in response. It is. It's a royal waste of time in the best way. And I'm so grateful that you find this space to come to every week. And this week I felt it as you were singing behind me. Felt the goodness of that. So thanks, worship team, for leading us in song. Thanks, Melinda, for your wonderful welcome that ties in beautifully with the sermon today. Javon, for your prayer. And, you know, there's a few people that I'd be willing to pay money to listen to a recording of them read the Bible. Paul Bordine's one of them. I'd be willing to pay money to listen to him read the Bible. And I'm thinking Nolan Bell's one of them too. Like the comics version of the Bible, right? I think there's something to that. We might want to consider this. So. Okay, let's reflect just a little bit on our gospel passage today from Mark 9. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. I'd like to talk to you today about the ministry. The ministry of Peter, James, and John. That is, I'd like to say a word about the gift they offer to Jesus. But to understand the gift, I'm thinking a bit of context will be helpful for us. Because you see, 6 days ago, 6 days before Jesus and his companions head up that high mountain, Jesus was teaching a crowd of disciples, people who believed Jesus was the Messiah. People who dared to believe that Jesus was the one who would finally set the world right, who would drive out the Romans, reunite the kingdom, usher in the golden age of victory for God's people. And to these people, these disciples, with these high hopes, 6 days ago, Jesus said, "The Son of Man must undergo great suffering. He must be rejected and he must be killed." News, as you can imagine, that came across as a bit of a downer to the otherwise optimistic outlook those disciples were carrying with them. I'd suggest it was probably about as well received as a presidential candidate informing donors and supporters, "After all your hard work on my behalf, your belief in me, your millions of dollars in donations, I plan in late October to resign, end my campaign, and drop out of the race entirely. Who's with me?" Hearing Jesus inform them that their best hope for salvation in nearly 2 centuries was himself going to be defeated was just about the worst news imaginable. Quite like a presidential candidate ending their campaign 8 days before the election. And that crowd felt betrayed. And who wouldn't? And all that disappointment and all that heartache that those people were feeling, it all came out in the voice of one Simon Peter, who said to Jesus that day, "It shall never be." And then, speaking for all who had put their trust in him, rebuked Jesus for even thinking such a thing. And again, who wouldn't be tempted to do the same? But Jesus, despite the pressure to be something different for these people, what they wanted, what they needed, replied, "You know what? Not only will I suffer, but you will too if you follow me." Jesus said, "Honestly, it's going to be a lot like carrying a cross." He's like the candidate for presidency saying to his constituents, "Not only will I be dropping out of the race come October, but all of your precious policies will be shut down right along with me." Which is why we're not at all surprised to hear Mark then say the people were ashamed of Jesus. "This man is the Messiah?" And then, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John and led them up a high mountain. Intriguingly, Mark tells us nothing about those 6 days in between. Nothing about what they must have been like. But then again, perhaps there's no need. For we all know what it is to struggle through moments of disagreement and disappointment, don't we? And we know what it is to then sit with that conflict and stress in our heart for days. I wonder if you've ever been there before. I know I most certainly have. Replaying it all in our minds over and over again, feeling misunderstood, misheard, mistreated for all those days, and wondering if perhaps everyone else feels just the same. 6 days, Mark says, of silence. And I suspect we know just what those days were like, for we've lived them many times before. And that is precisely the context in which Jesus then heads up that high mountain with his friends. We've not heard a word from anyone since Peter rebuked Jesus and Jesus rebuked him in return. Since Jesus, in what we can only presume was utter frustration, cried out to that crowd and then doubled down on his dire predictions. Since then, we've not heard in the Gospel of Mark a single word until this hike. And all of that, I'd like to suggest, helps clarify for us just what this moment means. Just what is at stake on that high mountain. And just what Peter, James, and John did for Jesus. That is so utterly important and profound. Okay, so there's my introduction. There's our context setting for the moment. But I'd like to pause for just a second, and I want to share with you a short story. It's a bit of a detour, but it's something that I hope will help make all of this talk of the high mountain make more sense and become more clear. I'd like to share with you a story of something that happened to me about 6 days ago on a basketball court at Columbia Christian. My daughter had just finished her game. And while we were waiting for the team to come out from the locker room, my son, Cohen, along with a bunch of other kids, decided to shoot around a bit on the court. And one other parent and I joined in. Now, let me just say, it's been a while since I've shot a basketball. Even longer since I've played on a team. But as with many people my age, I still presume I'm just as capable as I have always been on the basketball court. And so, despite the fact that I've got on a coat and a sweatshirt and jeans, despite the fact that I've not warmed up one bit, despite the fact that this is the first time I've shot a basketball in that gym in 5 years, I picked up a ball and fired off a three-point shot. In retrospect, I realize now it would have been a wiser choice to begin with a layup. Or or a free throw or two, perhaps a mid-range jumper, and then, and only then, attempt a three-point shot. But no. This, I said to myself, is a shot I can absolutely make. And so I went for it and fired up a three. Now, before I tell you the result, I do feel it's important to emphasize I was shooting a ball that's slightly smaller than the one I am used to. And as I've said, I've not shot in that gym in a while. And I did have on a really bulky jacket. All to say, when I stepped to the three-point line and let that ball fly, I knew immediately. I missed the rim. I missed the backboard. I missed any and every part of that net. From the moment the ball left my hands to the moment it crashed to the floor, the only other thing it ever touched was air. Unobstructed, clean air. In basketball lingo, it's known as an air ball. It's about the worst shot you can offer. And yet, as disappointing as all that is, that wasn't what really upset me 6 days ago. You see, when I grabbed that basketball, stepped back to that three-point line, it was one of those moments where the people in that gym paused for just a beat. Hey, the kids said, Mr. Reed's gonna shoot. The kids, they paused. The other adult present paused. My son paused and watched me shoot. As I've said, I should have begun with a lay-in. I felt like Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games. Do you remember that? Missing the first bow shot while the judges watched, and then entirely ignored her afterwards, having already made up their minds about who and what she was. I wanted to cry out to everyone in the gym after I threw up that air ball, wait, that's not me. I don't normally shoot that badly. In fact, what I did was I immediately grabbed the ball once again, stepped back, shot another three to prove that I could do better, and missed once again everything. But by now, no one was even paying attention. So that when I grabbed the ball one more time, told myself, enough of this, took a couple dribbles, stepped back, and then drilled the three-point shot. Not a single person in that gym saw. I turned to the adult and said, hey, not bad, right? He wasn't listening. I turned to Cohen to say, hey, 1 for 3 is not all that bad, huh? But he was off with his friends by then, playing his own game. And I'd like to say, I let it all go at this point. But lying while you're preaching is not a good look. All I could think was that those kids and that parent now thought, I'm the type of player who's more likely than not to shoot an air ball. And it grated at me, feeling misunderstood and unseen for the basketball player I knew I could be. Perhaps not the best athlete on the court, but certainly someone capable of making a single shot. Well, why in the world have I told you all of that? Because of this. 6 days ago, from the perspective of his friends and followers, Jesus threw up a theological air ball. And based on Mark's record of the event, we can tell it grated at him, leaving him feeling misunderstood and unseen for the Messiah he knew himself to be. As John records in the same event, because of that moment, many disciples turned back and no longer even followed him. For 6 days, Jesus and his disciples sat with all of this until he and his closest friends headed to the top of that high mountain. And I wonder, did they say anything to one another as they walked up that hill? Could they feel the tension between them as they hiked up that mountain? Or were they simply silent as they walked? We don't know. Mark doesn't say. But what we do know is this. Somewhere on the top of that high mount, Jesus was transfigured before them. And those disciples, perhaps for the very first time, could finally see. In their hearts, in their minds, finally see him for exactly who he'd always been. Despite the airball, they still didn't understand. And that, I believe, is everything. It was a gift on that mountain, not simply for them, but rather in that moment, in that scene, after those 6 days, it was a gift, I believe, from them to Jesus himself. After 6 days, after all those people leaving him because they could not understand him, Jesus was finally, truly seen. And if you've ever had a moment where you were misunderstood, misheard, disregarded, unseen, well, then maybe you know just what that might mean. For somebody to finally get you. For someone to finally know you. For someone to finally see you as you. You know, 6 days ago, I shot an air ball and came across as a pretty poor basketball player. But honestly, big deal, right? I'm basically over it. But let me ask you this. Not about my basketball skills, but what about those parts of me that are a big deal and that remain unseen? Those things that tie in most closely to what it means to be me. Identity things. What about those same parts in you? What about those same parts in all the people of our parish? You know, it's curious that Jesus tells the disciples as they descend that high mountain, do you remember this? Not to tell anyone. And the reason, Mark will later explain, is because Jesus knew it was not safe for him to be truly known as he was, truly seen. What an extraordinary thing. Jesus did not feel safe being truly seen for who he was. And I suspect we probably know what that's like, too. To say to someone, please, don't tell anyone else. I don't feel safe. Which makes what Peter, James, and John offer all the more important that day. For the fact of the matter is, we simply cannot live. The Messiah himself cannot live without someone, some group who truly sees us for who we are. And creates a safe space for us to simply be. And that, I believe, is the entire point today. And that, I'd like to say, is the calling for you and for me. to offer up the same sort of ministry these three disciples shared with Jesus. I don't need for you to believe, not really. I don't need for you to believe that I can make a three-point shot. I mean, if you want to come to the gym with me, I will shoot a few and show you. But let me say, I don't need you to believe that I can make a three-point shot. But I do need for you to really see me and offer me space to be me. And you need that same thing, as do our neighbors, as does our parish, as do friends of ours right here in this very room. For the miracle of this moment is not simply that Jesus is transfigured, but that Peter, James, and John are able to offer Jesus the gift of truly being seen in a world where such sight is unfortunately all too rare. So he's counting. I suspect we can imagine ways that people around us feel unseen. And my prayer in response to this gospel passage is this: may we, East County, be the same sort of high mountain place for our community. May this room be the space where you are seen. May we too share in that extraordinary gift of sight, of really seeing one another, and maybe even being truly seen. Amen.